Tibeca,
the podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles, and critical believers. RevLab.
Welcome to this episode of More Tibeca with Carla Maurer and Laurin Redding. We are two Swiss nationals in London, and in our podcast, we are taking you to our favorite places in the British capital and sometimes beyond. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Laurin.
But first, Carla told me to meet her at 81 St. Stephen's Road, and there is a big council block. Nothing special about it, really. It's just a house. What brings us to this building?
So 81 St. Stephen's Road was my very first flat in London. And well, obviously it's nostalgic for me, but I also thought there is actually quite a lot to talk about when it comes to renting in London. It's quite a big topic, especially when you come from Switzerland. So I thought, why not start with my first flat? I shared that with two flatmates and with my then boyfriend. And there was just enough space downstairs to squeeze in a dining table, a sofa, and the TV. So it was really quite small, everything. And what I really remember is that the bathroom that didn't have a window and was a very small square room was just, the ceiling was black with mold. Do you have any experiences like that?
Oh, yes. Oh, that is always a problem. I've been there as well. I had two flats where the bathroom didn't have any windows and the ventilation system was rather old. And then that's the sad conclusion that happens. So yeah, always, it's always important to give a good clean in houses in London, at least the ones I've lived in.
Yeah. And I think if you move over from Switzerland and you're used to the standard of flats in Switzerland, it can be a bit of a shock. But I didn't really mind it at the time. I thought it was just amazing to finally move to London and to be united with my boyfriend after 3 years of commuting. Yeah, and, you know, kind of used a place for sleeping. London is so exciting. And if you get on with your flatmates, you can pay your bills. I mean, that's, yeah, you have a bit of mold in the bathroom ceiling, but I guess that's just what it is. Yeah, I think this whole thing about renting in London, that's just also why I took you to 81 St. Stephen's Road, because there were just a few things I had to get my head around when I first moved to London. And that one of the things is really that there is nothing like a Mieterschutz in the UK, or very, very basic, like the renter's protection, which is quite high in Switzerland. But here, I mean, I hear people, I think legally you can be chucked out of your flat with a 2 weeks notice, if I'm right. And so you can be in a situation where you just have to find another flat within 2 weeks. And very often, like the landlords, so the people who own the flat that you live in, they're not really too bothered about looking after the flat or sorting things out when they're not working properly.
And you can do that because the demand is so high. I mean, everybody wants to be in this really cool city. Well, maybe a bit less so after Brexit and maybe coronavirus. But I think, I mean, it's so amazing. I think that's part of the reason why we both want to be here. It's such a cool city. You know, you don't spend much time in the flat anyway, because there's so much to see, to do, to eat, to listen to. And then that's fine. That's the price you pay to have a little bit of an expensive, not very good flat if you can be in the best city in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think most people do not live in London to be in a lockdown during a pandemic. I think that's just really something you don't expect, because otherwise I think you would probably not make the compromises you usually make. Yeah, so I do really feel...
That's true. It's not such a good deal.
Yeah, no, I do really feel for certain people it must have been difficult, yeah. But I think as well, like this whole thing with flat, it shows also a mentality, or I would even say like it says something about the how you think about your retirement, because your retirement provision in Britain really is that you get on the property ladder. You buy as soon as you can, if you can make savings, you buy a flat, because pensions here are quite low. So your pension is basically to have a flat and have somewhere to live and pay off the mortgage. And then when you're retired, you have somewhere to live. Whereas in Switzerland, it's more that you save up cash and you have a very strong pension system. So you can basically rent your whole life and still pay your rent once you're retired. And that's a very different kind of mindset that I found.
It's a very different mentality as well. And, you know, when the property ladder, where the idea is also, you know, you buy a house, then it increases in value, you sell it, you can buy a more expensive house. And therefore, you know, on the idea of the ladder, you move like up until you're old. But that requires that you start very early. So I have a lot of, well, I know friends my age who already bought a house and or they own a house. And I'm like, whoa, how did this happen? I never thought about this, you know, until now. But I feel like already having been here for a while, I have these thoughts in my head as well. I found myself looking at potential houses to buy as well. So it's really that mentality that I'm getting used to.
Yeah,
now.
It kind of shifts, doesn't it? Once you're in the UK for a few years, yeah. I think like people our age in Switzerland, they talk a lot about their cash pension, how to build it up. And here in the UK, everyone talks about getting on the property ladder and buy a flat.
I remember when I had my first job, or I know, like, I suppose most people, when they have their first job in Switzerland, you start talking about your pension, or your bank invites you to talk about the dritte Säule, you know, like your money on the side, the third pillar. And I always thought that was quite funny and, you know, like laughed about people who thought about their retirement when they just had their first job. It's, you know, why don't you enjoy life now? But of course, you need to somehow think about it. And in Switzerland, it's the pension. In the UK, it's the property ladder.
Yeah, very different systems. I also want to take you to another place, and that's just across the road. You might be surprised. It's a church.
We can't have an episode of More Tea Wicca without the church.
No. So our neighbours in St. Stephen's Road were a really mixed bunch of people. And I think in one flat were former inmates. There was a bit of drug and alcohol abuse sometimes going on, the big dark barking dog. And then there was this as well, this really beautiful looking elderly Caribbean lady who walked past our kitchen window every Sunday with her Sunday best and a big nice hat. And I was wondering where she went. And then I found out one day, because I joined the church, or I went to some church services across the road in this church, and she was there as well. So, and I met her. So it's something really nice about local churches, is that you meet the neighbors you would never usually meet. And especially in a really diverse community, like around Roman Road, where we used to live, is this mix of people that I think you really only find in churches. So the church is called St. Paul Old Ford, and it was led by a really amazing vicar. It's still the vicar who is there now, we will hear from him later, is amazing as well. But at the time it was Philippa Boardman, and she later became the canon treasurer at St. Paul's Cathedral. So that's a very prestigious ministry. I mean, the St. Paul's Cathedral.
The big one, yeah.
Yeah, I think she moved on from there now. But she really revived the church, and the vicar who's there now, James, he will tell us later a bit more about that. But what is interesting about this church, and it's there are certain similarities with the Swiss church.
How so?
Well, we did something similar to the building. They're both, well, the St. Paul Old Ford church building was basically derelict, and it was almost sold to, you know, repurpose the church. But then the community, together with the then vicar, Philippa, decided to raise funds to renovate the church and to continue the whole thing as a church and to make it a really lively community center. And I mean, that's just an amazing effort. You have to raise millions to do that. And they somehow pulled it off. And now it's a really lively community center. And so the comparison to the Swiss church is that you have this church structure. And very often church buildings are listed buildings. That's the Denkmalschutz in Switzerland. And you can't really do anything to the structure. So you have to be quite innovative in terms of the architecture. And both churches, St. Paul Old Ford and the Swiss church, came up with a similar idea. And that was to build some kind of glass cube in the building, but freestanding, so you don't have to touch the old walls, and also to take out the pews,
the benches,
yeah, exactly. And I think that is something we often forget, is that the church building you have can really restrict the activities you can do in a church. And if you want to change the way you do church, a very good start is to think about how you want to change the church building, so you can actually do the things you want to do in the physical space. So yeah, for that reason, it just always reminded me of the Swiss church as well when I went to St. Paul Old Ford. And actually now I have the pleasure to introduce the vicar who is now at St. Paul Old Ford, and who will tell us how they renovated the church and what the church stands for.
My name is Reverend James Houston. I'm the vicar of St. Paul Old Ford in Tower Hamlets in East London. St. Paul's is a building that was built by the Victorians 142 years ago, but in 1991 part of the roof fell in and the small congregation at the time decided they couldn't do the necessary work to keep the building open. And it was closed in 1991. It was to remain closed for the next 13 years. And during that time, there were lots of different voices from outside the local church suggesting it should be demolished or sold off. But the local congregation of about 20 people and my predecessor as vicar felt God had given them a vision to reopen the building. And so they worked hard to engage the local community. They worked hard to fundraise. And over the period of 8 years, they were able to raise £3.5 million. They were able to engage the community, both those in the church and those outside of it. And they were able to craft a vision for the building to be a place of safety and refuge, a place of transformation in the community. In 2004, St. Paul's was reopened with its iconic arch, a pod-like structure in the inside of the church. And today we continue to serve our local community, and one of the main tools for doing that is our building. Within the church itself, we have a gym for people with life-changing conditions and disabilities, educational charity, cafe, a full-time youth work programme. We have about 30 to 40 community groups that regularly use the space, and we've become an important part of presence and being present in this local community and serving the people of the area, particularly the most vulnerable. The congregation has also grown from that same 20 people who came across when, or back into the building when the church was reopened, to now about 150. Part of the reason for that, I think, is because the journey the congregation went on with the building being closed and then reopening, the vision they felt God had given them and the faithfulness that God showed transformed our view as a church. It transformed our view of God and transformed our expectations about him. Because of that journey with the building, because of how we see God working in our midst now, we are expectant that God will do wonderful things. We are hopeful that God can bring new life, even from death and despair. And we are joyful, and we celebrate all that God has done and the journey that God has brought us on. What that means is the picture of the God we show to people as we serve them and as we share the good news of Christ in words and deeds is one that I hope is hopeful and joyful, and one that I hope welcomes people in, just as our building now serves and welcomes in the local community. The building itself is not just a useful tool in serving the community and a witnessing to God's love. It is a poignant reminder to us of the God that continues to call us on, go before us, and the God in whom we can trust to do wonderful and miraculous things.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
That was better.
I heard you a bit later again, but it might just be the delay on the phone.
That could be, yeah. But before, no, honestly, before I was waiting for you to say 4 for some reason, so I was definitely...
What?
I don't know why.
Why on earth? Well.
Okay.
Well, on that note, let's go to the vicar's question. This week we have the traditional, I would say, theological question. Why does a loving God allow for so much misery to happen?
And we have to say this was sent in before the whole COVID-19 pandemic started.
That's true, yeah. It's not related directly, but it's a question that is asked very often at the moment in churches, and a lot of ministers also write about it or preach about it. But it's a very timeless question, of course, yeah.
And even I remember as a child, I once was at, don't laugh now, at a children's university.
Sorry.
And you did laugh. It's actually quite a cool thing. It's like when the University of Zurich did like a week, a year where it was open for children, and there was like lectures that children could attend. And obviously it was tailored to what kids were interested in. And one of the questions was exactly this one. Why is there misery in the world, even though there is a God, an almighty God?
Little Irene.
So wow. I'm still,
do you
so
remember
I'm still
what
very
they
interested.
Said? Did it, what did
no,
it
I don't you? Remember. Oh, no.
But you remember that it was a question. And I mean, remembering the question sometimes is more important than the answers.
That's true. And and the fact that I still remember, because I don't remember anything else from that time, but I still remember this question. So it definitely must have left an impression.
Yeah, well, I personally think you will become a theologian one day, but that's another topic.
Another topic, yeah. Okay, let's hear your answer. It's about you, not about me. You're the vicar.
Yeah, it is one of the biggest questions in theology. So not just for people who, you know, who are very suspicious of theology, of faith, and, you know, can't really make sense of it, but for theologians, for ourselves at university, that's one of the big questions that we discuss in dogmatics. That's one of the areas of theology. And it even has a name. So the question why God allows, a loving God allows misery to happen or certain things to happen is called theodicy. Theodizee, die Theodizee-Frage. And so, yeah, it even has a name. And that's a question that all theology students will be very familiar with, and all ministers, because we have to, because there is a lot of violence in the Bible, and also our experience of life obviously can be very violent, or the things we hear are happening to other people or in other parts of the world, to our neighbors or to ourselves. That how does that make sense if there is an all-powerful and all-loving God? Why does all that happen? Why can the world not be a better place? So yeah, we are really in the very heart of theology with that question.
And now that you told me there's so many people who thought about this, and that there's loads of seminars about this, and you studied this as well, I'm expecting a very, very good answer.
Oh, dear.
Is there one?
there isn't one. And there's certain not just the one answer, but there are certain answers that I found for myself, I guess, how I can reconcile the loving God with the violence side of life experience and of biblical literature. So there are kind of certain ideas I have, but as I said, I mean, that's just really only, maybe a beginning even. So on one hand, I think what is, for me personally, very important is that what the Bible actually is, and we talked about this earlier already when we were in the British Museum, is that the Bible is a reflection of people's life experience. It reflects their journey with God. It reflects their spirituality and the historic context. And because there is so much human thinking and human experience in the Bible, it also reflects human nature. And human nature, well, is violent and is loving. And we are made in God's image. And God became human, so you will find all these attributes in God as well. And that's obviously one way that's the way I look at the Bible. So depending on how people interpret the Bible, how they look at the Bible, you will find different answers. But for me, it's this really this knowing that people's experience influence massively the context and the content of the Bible. That's for me maybe one thread of answer to that question. And then a second one that's actually based on a very short book. The second thread, there is this book of a Jewish theologian called Hans Jonas, a German theologian, and he wrote a book with the title The Concept of God After Auschwitz. How can we believe in a God after the Holocaust? And Jonas says that there are three aspects to God, that God is all-knowing, he is all-powerful, and he's all good. His only intention is good. And that God can only be two of those at any one time.
Two of those three. So yeah. It's like a triangle and it can only be two ends.
Yeah.
One line.
And because I believe, personally, I think that God is all good and that God is all knowing, but that God is not or not always all powerful. And that's for me how I also make sense of God and why that works. And it's also because we are given freedom and we are given responsibility by God to live in this world. So our freedom has to do with that thought that perhaps God doesn't want to or can't always intervene, because we are free to act and we have a responsibility for our actions. Otherwise, we could just say, oh, you know, it's not me and God didn't intervene. So, you know, it's not my fault. But no,
we need to be accountable.
We are accountable and we are responsible for our actions. And that's, I think, has to do with that thought that God is not all powerful. And also this is actually connected to the story of the expulsion from paradise. If we go back to Eve and Adam, the first people, according to the Bible. And you know, there is this scene when they eat the fruit. And we talked about that earlier as well, I think. It's not an apple, it's a fruit. We turn into an apple. And God said to them, look, you are not allowed to eat that fruit, but if you do, you will know the difference between good and bad. And you will have to bear the consequences of that. So he kind of left them the choice. And Adam and Eve decided, oh, we do want to have that wisdom. We want to be accountable. We want to be responsible. And so they did eat the fruit. And God didn't intervene. And because of that, they had to leave this blissful place, the paradise, and they had to face the real world. And that has all to do with that, yeah, accountability, responsibility, which goes hand in hand with God not always intervening, because either he can't or he doesn't want to or she doesn't want to.
Is it in some way also fair to say that we are mature in the sense that we lead our own lives and, as you said, we are responsible for the things that happen, but we also know that when misery occurs, that it is often connected to our actions. And therefore, it's our choice to do that. So we have to earn our freedom and our good life, in a sense. And it's not just given to us, sort of for free, but we need to do something for it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good thought. And I think as a humanity, we can act. We can influence things and we can make our choices. And very often we take very bad choices. They're just so multi-layered and connected. And as an individual, it's very hard to do anything about it. But if we look at ourselves as part of humanity, with that ability to act and to change things, even though maybe in our daily life it's very hard to feel or see that connection somehow. But humanity in relation to God, I think that's very true what you say, yes.
I think it's sometimes also difficult to think about this from the perspective that we live in an individualistic society where we only think we are sort of in the center of our lives. Whereas maybe God gave this responsibility, you know, to Adam and Eve together, in the sense to humanity as a collective. And I think it's, at least for me, I find it very difficult to think in a collective way instead of an individualistic way, you know, that it's not just my own responsibility and my own misery, my own action, but it's always us together whether it's a smaller community or a bigger or a country or even the world. I find it very difficult to think in these terms, but maybe that's how it was meant to be as well. So it's not that I need to feel powerless myself, but I always need to think myself in a group, in a community somehow.
It's a very good point you raise here with the our individualistic thinking and our maybe inability, but you know, the struggle to think of a collective. And maybe that's something that church does or that religion does. At least it does it for me, that I really think in much broader terms, perhaps since I joined the church, since I became a theologian, it opened up that dimension that we are part of a collective. And it is really a different way of thinking, actually. And I haven't really thought about it like that. And for me, being part of the church really helps me to take that perspective. Even like just the church community represents that. It would be a bit dull. I just think paradise maybe is a bit dull. And I think Adam and Eve probably thought that and they wanted to change. Why else would they have eaten the fruit if it would have been such a great place to be? I'm sure it's good to be in paradise for a little bit. But it also, it restricts, it also takes away a lot of other aspects from what we identify with being human, as you just said. And so I understand that they wanted out and they didn't know the consequences of it. And that's just to go back into that, yeah.
So God didn't only give us misery or let misery happen, but actually he got us the opportunity and the responsibility to act in our own right, to confront misery or to let it happen, to make good things and be happy or not, depending on what we do. So maybe this would be another answer or another question.
Or to use that word that's very often used nowadays is like God empowered us, or he let us to empower ourselves by taking that decision that's what we want to be as human beings. It's a question of empowerment, and we wouldn't have if God would always intervene, that would also mean the end of that empowerment, and we don't want to let go of the empowerment. We want to be active. We want to influence things as human beings. I think it's very much our how we identify as humans. And so the flip side of the coin is that God just sometimes just looks at us, or very often it's just like, what on earth? Like literally, what on earth are they doing? And it's good we ask that question. You know, it's we have to keep asking that question, because asking that question, why God lets this happen, brings us exactly to our own responsibility and to our accountability as humans on this earth. And maybe if we end up, if that's where we end up with that thought or with that question, then that's a starting point again to maybe rethink how we do things and what we can do better.
And now for some music from our brilliant organist Peter Yardley Jones. Thank you.
RefLab.